Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 27, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Jan Keeson. Today's session number is KEJ 2001-6 and is titled Better Sleep with a Sober Cannibal Than a Drunken Christian. Let's listen in.
Past week is what makes great literature? What are the criteria that make great literature? We read lots of books nowadays, and there's lots of arguments as to what makes great lit, what should be in the canon, and whether there should be a canon of any kind of literature, particularly American literature, whether we should only read books by white males, or whether everybody should be entitled to write literature, and we have to give all of it equal credibility. But anyway, there's all kinds of arguments about that going on in my discipline right now. So what I'd like to talk with you a little bit about tonight is what is it that makes great lit? So for the first few minutes, just talk to me a little bit. Tell me, some of you or whoever would like to speak, what's the best book you ever read, and why is it the best book? Brothers Karamazov. Okay, well, why do you love this, Bob?
Because it describes human beings in a really honest, realistic way.
Okay, so what you're talking about here, so we have Brothers, okay, and you're saying it's honest and realistic.
Yeah, it expresses the human soul in it.
And has the human soul in it. All right. Anybody else? That's a tough book to read, by the way. I had to start that over several times because I kept getting confused about the names.
What was it?
Brothers Karamazov? Dostoevsky? Yes? Are you reading it? Are you far into it?
I'm like 60 pages in.
Are you having the same trouble that I did?
Yeah, flipping back constantly.
Yeah.
Look how fat it is. What is it, 900 pages?
No.
It's a lot.
780 something.
Well, that's an excellent example of a book that's a tough read. And you know it's a great book, and you know you're going to understand literature. It's one of the great books you're supposed to read, but it's hard to get into. So I want to talk a little bit about why that is pretty soon. Anybody have a book where you'll begin by saying, I know it's not really a great book, but I love this book? You?
She's fixing her hair.
What do you love to read? How about you? Tell me your name.
I'm Carla.
Carla, what do you love to read, Carla?
Oh gosh, I don't know. Little of everything, I guess.
Okay, little of everything. Everything meaning what?
Oh, I don't know.
No? You like mystery novels?
No.
No? Anybody like to read Patricia Cornwell or? Okay.
I like mystery novels.
All right, okay, tell us what you like to read. You're David, right?
I'm David. I also like spy novels. I like what her name is.
John Le Carre. Okay. So I met somebody at Augustana College not so long ago, a father of one of my students, who says that has to be one of the greatest books of all time. And it's John Le Carre as the spy came in.
Yeah, that's a wonderful book. Really.
Okay, what's good about it?
It's just so horrible.
It's horrible? All right.
The situation that it describes is horrible.
I always have trouble with these markers.
What makes it horrible is it sets you up to believe in who are the heroes, allies, and enemies, and who are the good guys and bad guys. And it turns that totally upside down.
Okay. So in terms of your value system, or in terms of who you like to root for?
Both. It does it first of all with the characters, and then by doing that it turns the value system upside down.
So it questions, perhaps, huh? Or it just, all right, so I'll just write down what you said. Turns the value system. Does it make you question to whom you want to support, the person you would like to support the most?
Yeah.
And it makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah, really uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else? All right, let me write down uncomfortable. Anybody else?
I really like children's literature.
Okay.
And two that have always struck me. One of the things, one of the standards I like to put on good, my idea of good children's literature is that it has two levels. One at which the children can understand and enjoy the story, and another level at which adults.
Okay, interesting. All right, so we have two levels.
Yeah.
All right.
And one of those is Winnie the Pooh.
Okay.
And the other one is E.B. White. What is it?
Charlotte.
Yeah, Charlotte. There's
all right, so we have Milne.
Yeah.
And White.
And
E.B. White.
Yeah. And there, throughout both of those pieces, there is such a running commentary on the on human nature.
Okay.
That right. I find.
So we're getting back to some of the things, the issues that Bob talked about in terms of human soul or human nature. Ooh. We like stories like this. And David was saying, I love to read Le Carre because he's so horrible. What you're saying is he turns those things upside down. It's really uncomfortable for me. All right. Anything else? Anybody else? Judy, how about you?
It's a really tough question.
Yeah?
My favorite all-time book.
I don't know.
Because that is, I haven't ever stopped to think about it, and I love it. Heidi came to my mind.
Okay.
And as a children's book, and that would be the one that probably isn't great writing, but meant a lot to me as a child, and I still somehow relate as an adult to the wonder of that and to the compassion that's in it.
All right. All right, anybody else? Anything else that should happen in a great book?
Well, a good writer. We haven't said something about writing in here.
Okay.
So that was playing in my mind too. Like Stegner, Wallace Stegner is
all
an
right.
author I like very much.
Angle of Repose?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So there.
And so you're talking about, we're talking about style now maybe.
Okay,
huh?
That's
moving
the word.
Toward that.
That's the word, thank you.
Okay, so that's a concern, something that's beautifully written.
Yes, the words alone just, you say, oh, I love this book.
Yeah.
Look how this author puts words together.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, I had somebody in my class last week that said, I love Lolita because it's so beautifully written. I wonder what would happen if I would teach Lolita today. Humbert, falling in love with a prepubescent girl and writing stories. What might we call that today? Porn? But it's beautifully written. There's no question of it. And I can remember the first time I read Lolita occurred when I was a freshman in high school. And I came from a very strict background. I was going to a Christian high school. And I knew two things when I read Lolita. One, that it was beautifully written, enough to take my breath away, and two, that I should not be reading it. So I kept it under my mattress. And I got in lots of trouble in the springtime when we changed mattress pads and sheets. Because I, by that time, had forgotten. All right. When I asked the students at Augustana College what makes a great book, I said, this kind of alarmed me. Just about before I was going on sabbatical, I said to them, you've had all of American literature in one quarter. You know criticism, you know genre, you know all the things graduating seniors are supposed to know. Tell me, what makes a great book? And they looked at me dumbfounded. Pretty soon all their heads were down on their desks. They're really busy looking at their papers. So I just waited. And I said, okay, you have to say. So one of them said, it's got to be emotionally moving. And I said, okay, that's like if you're standing in line in the grocery store and you see the National Enquirer and it says, it's headless man found in topless bar. I said, that's something that'll spark up your emotions, right? And you want to keep reading it. And they said, no, it's not like that. And then somebody said, it has to have layers of meaning to it. And so I thought, yeah, that's a good idea. I said, like my insurance policy, right? There's lots of layers of meaning. And so that's fine literature. I said, no, that's not fine literature. So then, it's got to be something that you feel strongly about, that moves you. And I said, okay, how about Theodore Kaczynski's letter to the New York Times, the Unabomber's letter to the New York Times? That was full of passion, and he was trying to persuade us of something. Is that fine literature? Well, no. So anyway, by that time, everybody was confused. And I think people in my own discipline are confused too. So you could take this for what it's worth, but I'm of the opinion now that we need to set at least some standards for starting points. And you can disagree with them all you want or add more. But anyway, this is what we thought of at Augie. And my students weren't that far off. But the first thing that any fine literature does is something that fires your soul. It's the wow, you've got to read this book factor. All right? So the first thing is it fires your soul. It's like really fine passages in scripture. Isaiah 53. I don't know of anything that's more beautifully written than that. He was despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we esteemed him not. You know, what could be more beautifully written than that? Or some of the Psalms. Or some of the stuff I'm going to read to you in Moby Dick today. All right, so something that fires your soul. The second one is one that William Styron gave to us when he came to visit, and that's another happy story. We have time between now and Vespers, I'll tell you that story, because that involves Paul Olson, and some of you probably know him. Anyway, William Styron said, you have to have a central character who comes alive. And it can be a town, or it can be a person. It can be in Huck Finn. I won't get to talk about Huck Finn, but some people say that's a racist novel. It's not. Because Jim becomes a human being. And right at the turnaround of the novel, Huck sees him as property, but he also realizes that he's a human being. And he's worth more than $30, and he's also, in the end, for Huck anyway, worth going to hell for. And it's all right then, I'll go to hell if I have to follow these Sunday school values and turn in Jim. So the reason that happens is because he remembers all the times that Jim took care of him, and on the raft, when it was his turn for watch, Jim would let him, you know, he'd let him sleep, and all the times he called me honey, and all the times he cared for me. And Jim becomes alive there. He becomes a human being, and we just weep over the very notion, just like David was talking about, where you might want to follow the law, but you think, no, there's something higher than the laws we have here in society. And Huck, who's dumb like a fox, sees this, you know, and the rest of the people don't. So you have a central character who comes alive. The third characteristic is exactly what Judy was getting after, something beautiful. And that has to do with rhythm, syntax, precision of diction, tension. It's just like the beauty in any fine piece of music, in an excellent painting. But anyway, something beautiful. And I'll try and read you some passages today in Moby Dick that I think are beautiful. Fourth criteria is something of ethical significance. And the fifth criteria is something you want to return to. And a lot of us like to read mystery novels. Le Carre is in a different class than, say, Patricia Cornwell. I'll take Patricia Cornwell home at night and I think, oh, whoopee, I've got this really exciting page turner to read after I've studied hard and thought hard all day long. And there's something about it. You just can't wait to open it. And you know, I live in a log cabin, and when I'm reading Patricia Cornwell, I wish I had drapes on my cabin because it's scary. But what happens with her, I never want to read her again. And what also happens is sometimes I'll make the mistake of taking the same novel home, and I'll open it up, and I think, oh, I already read this. And it's just so utterly forgettable. But anyway, those are the criteria of great books. For starters, anyway. Now, why is Moby Dick a great book? Well, maybe first we better talk a little bit about Moby Dickophobia. Most of us know we're supposed to read Moby Dick, and we're supposed to like it, and it's one of the icons of American literature. And if you want to position yourself as someone who knows something about American literature, you can say, well, of course, in Moby Dick, and so on and so on. But the fact of the matter is a lot of us are uncomfortable reading Moby Dick. We don't really like it. You don't like all the whale stories. There's too many words. It's too complicated to hear. So anyway, I felt the same way when I first started reading it. So what you need to do, folks, is lighten up. All right? Think of some of the, I usually pass around cartoons. In Charlie Brown, there's a cartoon of Sally sitting down, and she has a writing assignment, and she's been trying to write, and pages are dropped below the desk, and she just can't seem to get going, and finally she writes, and it says on there, Dick Moby. And Charlie Brown looks at her and he says, you know that's wrong. And so she scratches it out, and then she writes on there, Richard Moby. And we all laugh because writing a writing assignment on Moby Dick would be the assignment from hell, right? Write a page on Moby Dick. Everybody, it's just too awful to imagine for a lot of students. Another cartoon that I saw on Moby Dick was from The Far Side. I think that's my very favorite one. There's rush hour traffic. Great big car has rear end and another one, and the guy who's in the car that has rear-ended the first is Moby Dick. And he's opening and he's looking through the windshield and he sees this kind of cranky looking crotchety figure get out, and you see a peg leg stepping out, and under the caption it says, bummer, of all the people in this traffic, and I rear-end him. But anyway, let's take a look at the first chapter here, and there's lots of other things to talk about before the first chapter, but we only have a short time. It takes me at least 4 weeks to get through this book, but I'm going to try and get through parts of it today in an hour. Chapter one, first sentence, one of the most famous sentences in all of American literature, call me Ishmael. So right away, we know we have a narrator here who's telling a story, and he may not even be, he's just telling us what his name is. It could be somebody else. But anyway, in terms of lightening up, listen to this and try and listen to it with a lighter heart than maybe you had read it before. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I would sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul. Whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, you think he really is doing this? And especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off. Now, all right, so this, what he's saying, I think, is that I'm just really cranky. And he wants a change. He's got November in his soul, and I love to teach this novel in November. Okay, so anyway, the next thing that he says in here is that he wants to go to sea. And he talks about why people want to go to sea. I think it's a good thing to talk about right here in Holden Village, because any of us who hike always go where? We hike to Holden Lake, or we hike to Heart Lake, or we go past such and such a creek. But it's almost inevitable, or we go trout fishing, and where do we go?
Dole Lake.
Okay, Dole Lake. But I mean, that's always the goal, to go to some lake. And he makes the case that that's part of the human psyche, part of our human condition, that when we walk or when we navigate, we wind up by the water. I know I live out in the country, and I walk up and down hills every day for about 4 miles with my dog. And we always walk to the Edwards River and back. You know, we don't walk to the corner, or we don't walk 5 miles. We walk to the river and back. And I think that that's just part of our psyche. So he talks here a little bit about the magic of water, the magic hold that water has on us. And this goes on for a while, and you kind of have to let it happen while you're reading it. He also says, besides wanting to walk to water as a goal, he says, but that same image, we see ourselves in all rivers and oceans. It is the image of the ungraspable phantom of life, and this is the key to it all. So what he's saying too is not only do we walk to the water or walk to the ocean, but we see something in it, and it's some kind of a phantom of ourselves. So there certainly is more than one meaning here as to what we're looking for, and we have a hint that although we may be walking to the water, or although he may be going off whaling, he might be looking for something more than just literally whaling. And he also says in one of the earlier passages here, he does that communally, so the universal thump is passed around, and all hands should rub each other's shoulder blades and be content. I think that some of the dynamics that happens right here, we can all relate to it. You know, we go for a hike, or we go fishing, and there's something about, you know, rubbing each other's shoulders, a universal hump, or sharing thoughts during those times. So I guess what I'm getting at is, it's for starters, there's a universal appeal in what he says here that matters a whole lot. And then he gets into, all great books seem to have everything right in the very first chapter, all the issues. And it's true of Moby Dick too. But anyway, he talks about, and he plays around, he says, oh, it's an exercise, and I get paid, and there's a lot of other reasons for me to go. But then he gets into another issue. He says, the voyage formed part of the grand program of providence. So here you have at least some hint towards the notion that things might very well be predestined for folks. Well, he talks about the grand scheme of providence. All right. A lot of folks don't quite understand what Melville here means by providence. A lot of it comes back to this whole Calvinist notion of the tension between fate and free will. That tension arose, or the notion of providence, and with it predestination and election, arose from a lot of John Calvin's ideas. And Calvin got into this kind of conundrum, where he believed that God was omnipotent, all-powerful, and omniscient, all-powerful and all-knowing. So he knew everything and he controlled everything. When humankind fell, and some of us were damned, Calvin theorized that God would have to know who was damned and who was saved. Because if we had free will, like the Lutherans and some other folks believe it, that would take away from the control of God. All right? So, how are you gonna figure all this out? Well, then, because he's omniscient and omnipotent, he has to know everything from the beginning of time, and he also has to control everything. So humankind can't have free will. And what arose from that is trying to make some sense out of complicated doctrines. But anyway, what arose out of that are your doctrines of election and predestination that Calvinists still believe in. And some people are chosen by God from the beginning of time, and some are not. There's not a whole lot in some ways you can't do about it, except for the operation of grace. And your Calvinists today will point to grace and say, but God offers grace. Most of them prefer talking about it in that term. But still, there's that tension. And for Melville, it was interesting for him to play around with. He came from a Dutch Calvinist background. For Hawthorne, it was much more of a burden. He a lot of times wrote about the unpardonable sin. And that's interesting to see how that unfolds in a lot of his literature and short stories. But anyway, right at the beginning, you see that Melville brings this in, or Ishmael is talking about providence. Maybe this was part of the program of providence. And then, typical of Melville to do this in Moby Dick, right in the next paragraph, he talks about, though I can't tell why it is exactly, that those stage managers, the Fates, so, and he has Fates capitalized, put me down for this shabby part of a whaling voyage, when others were set down for magnificent parts in high tragedies and short and easy parts in general comedies and jolly parts in farces. Now you have all of those conventions in Moby Dick too. It's arguable that this is tragedy, it's comedy, it's farce. And you also have these elements of fate and free will. So if you're wondering why this is hard to read sometime, and if you think it's hard to read, chances are you're reading very carefully if you're feeling that it's hard to read, because it is, because there's so many things involved in here. Anyway, and in terms of what's beautiful, let me just read the conclusion of this chapter, and then I want to get on to his relationship with Queequeg. He talks about, finally, why he wants to go whaling. He says, not ignoring what is good, I am quick to perceive a horror and could still be social with it. So I don't know if that relates to anything David was reading, but I'm quick to perceive a horror and could still be social with it. But anyway, in terms of style, folks, beautiful. Let me just read you the end of the last paragraph of this first chapter. By reason of these things, then, the whaling voyage was welcome. The great floodgates of the wonder world swung open, and in the wild conceits that swayed me to my purpose, two and two there floated into my inmost soul endless processions of the whale, and midmost of them all, one grand hooded phantom, like a snow hill in the air. And here at the end of the first chapter, Moby Dick is introduced. All right, it takes us a while to get to him. Now, Ishmael, he does have November in his soul, and it is very cold. It's close to Christmas. The Moby Dick, the Pequod, the name of the ship, sails on Christmas Day. So just before Christmas, there, you know, a lot of these events are happening. And if you've ever been in Boston or a Martha's Vineyard or Nantucket in December, I'm sure you could say it's weather that will certainly rival what happens here in Holden. It's miserable, cold weather, unless you happen to like miserable cold weather like I do. But anyway, he was looking for a place to stay, and he didn't have a lot of money, and he goes around to different places. He finally winds up at the Spouter Inn. And the person who is the landlord of the Spouter Inn is a man named Peter Coffin. There are no free beds available. So Peter Coffin, and if you read this closely, I think he's setting up Ishmael. He just wants to see what's going to happen. But anyway, he says, well, he says, I have a bed you can share with somebody. And this guy's out right now, but you can share with him. During that time, it wasn't unusual for folks to share a bed. And this is about the only community that I know of that you could possibly do that. I know I've had a friend who was here last week, and I'm just always wondering if I'm going to get a roommate tomorrow or so. You know, that could happen kind of here, although probably not in the same bed. But anyway, Ishmael is really glad to get into this bed. And let me move on to, I'm glad it's a little bit light here. Yeah. Okay, I followed all my notes. How about that? Okay. So, anyway, he gets into this, and it is cold. And so he starts thinking about cold people and how it is to be cold. And he makes, there's this tension between comedy and the kind of artistic rhetoric that Melville has, where you have another message underneath. And here is an example of how that works. He said he's cold, and he kind of wishes, and metaphorically he says, yes, these eyes and this body of mine is the house. What a pity they didn't stop up the chinks and crannies, though, and thrust in a little lint here and there. But it's too late to make any improvements now. The universe is finished, and so he moves from his own body to the universe, and the copestone is on. And the chips were carted off millions of years ago. So then he talks about, and to me that's just beautiful language, and then he talks about Lazarus, and he says, poor Lazarus, I'm assuming most of you know who Lazarus was in the Bible, the beggar who was always cold and left out. And here he says, poor Lazarus, there chattering his teeth against the curbstone for his pillow, and shaking off his tatters with his shiverings. He might plug up both ears with rags and put a corn cob into his mouth, and yet that would not keep out the tempestuous Euroclydon, it's metaphorically the wind. Euroclydon, says old Dives in his red silken wrapper. Now where is Dives? He's in hell. And Melville says in parentheses, he had a redder one afterward, and he's joking around, the guy's in hell. Poo poo, what a fine frosty night. How Orion glitters, what northern lights. Let them all talk of their oriental summer climes of everlasting conservatories. Give me the privilege of making my own summer with my coal. So he's cold. Then he says, but what about Lazarus? Can he warm his blue hands by holding them up to the grand northern lights? So what a beautiful image to think of. If you see the northern lights and he's just so cold, and you're wondering if he could warm his hands by the starlight. Would not Lazarus rather be in Sumatra than here? So he's playing around with us. A little bit further on down, and this gets to be, you tell me what's happening a little bit further on down. Now, that Lazarus should lie stranded there on the curbstone before the door of Dives. This is more wonderful than an iceberg. I mean, wonderful meaning odd, exotic. Then an iceberg should be moored to one of the Moluccas. Yet Dives himself, he too lives like a czar in an ice palace made of frozen size. And being a president of a temperance society, he only drinks the tepid tears of orphans. What's Melville saying here? About power and people who's in control. What's he saying? He's a member of the Temperance Society. What's the Temperance Society?
Well, they don't drink alcohol or else they live sober lives, I guess.
Yeah, they're against alcohol, drinking alcohol. So they're members of the Temperance Society. So he's president of the Temperance Society, but what does he drink?
Something much worse than alcohol.
Yes. And what is it?
It was the tears of orphans.
The tepid tears of orphans. What's going on here? What's the bottom line of Melville's? Is he just talking about a nice palace and orphans' tears, or is there some other message here?
Not hypocrites.
Yeah, he's talking about what hypocrites Christians can be. All right. So anyway, with that in mind, and having his bed rented, he meets Queequeg. And Queequeg has all of the taboos. He has to be the absolute worst character that any of us could ever meet. Imagine yourself at Holden Village, sleeping peacefully in this nice, cool, brisk air, and a guy like Queequeg comes in. He's a savage, and he's been out selling head. And if you think that, you know, if you're kind of snickering a little bit about this, and you think, oh no, Melville wouldn't say what I'm thinking, he can't be that prurient or salacious, yeah, he is. Yeah, he is. But anyway, ostensibly, also, another layer of meaning is that he's selling these shrunken heads, okay? And he has to quit selling them. Does anybody know when? It's Saturday night. When would he have to quit selling them?
Oh,
12 o'clock. He has to quit selling them. Yeah, and you laugh because you wonder, who's buying these things, huh? And there's something ridiculous about buying shrunken heads and not being, you know, whoever buys them doesn't buy them on Sunday. So again, he's poking fun of people that are hypocritical. But anyway, Queequeg's out and he's doing this. So you think that he would be probably the most reprehensible character you could imagine. And he comes in there and he's got, I know tattoos are in right now, and everybody, almost all of my students have tattoos. But he has just tattoos all over his body, all little patches, and he's yellow, and he's scary looking, and he has this top knot. And he comes in, and he has this idol. So he's a savage. He may very well be prurient and salacious. He's spooky. And look what happens. So all the things that you would be afraid of, Queequeg is. All right. Let's see if I can pick. Melville tells it so much better than I. I confess, Ishmael says, I was now as much afraid of him as if it were the devil himself, who had just broken into my room at the dead of night. All right. So he had checker squares about his face, and you find out later on that he has the tattooed history of all of his generation, his heritage on him. And he comes from a very noble family. But anyway, all over his back there's these dark squares. He's this abominable savage that has landed in this, as Melville says, Christian country. I quake to think of it. So, I mean, you're starting to chuckle already because you know that Ishmael's going to set us up for this, right?
Yeah.
He has this curious little deformed image, this Congo baby, supposedly, that he carves at. And so he goes through this ritual before bed. He offers a little incense to this Yojo, which is the name of his idol. And then he takes some of his clothes off. He has this sing-song ritual, pagan, you know, he points down, Ishmael points out. He lights his tomahawk, grabs it between his teeth, and jumps into bed. Well, imagine if you were Ishmael, all right? I sang out. I could not help it now. And giving a sudden grunt of astonishment, he began feeling me. Well, that would really surprise you, wouldn't it? Queequeg's first line is, "Who de devil you? You speaky, dammy, or I kill ye."
Oh,
so anyway, not only does Ishmael not want him in bed, but now this savage is swearing at him. and feeling him and saying, who the devil are you? If you don't talk to me, I'm going to kill you. All right. So what Peter Coffin probably hoped happened, was going to happen, did happen. So anyway, he yells out, landlord, landlord, for God's sake, Peter Coffin, landlord, landlord, Coffin, angel, save me. And so anyway, pretty soon they settled down. And he finally says, Ishmael says, I said, looking at him for a moment, for all his tattooings, he was on the whole a clean, comely looking cannibal. Sorry. What's all this fuss I have been making about myself, I thought. A man's a human being just as I am. And he has just as much reason to fear me as I have to be afraid of him. And then he concludes, better sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian. So, that's the first time that they're together. And then, let me see what I have next. I think we're going to skip over to the next bedroom scene with them. All right. Okay, yeah. In the middle here, there's a chapel scene and there's a sermon. And then the next chapter, I'm at chapter 10 right now. We're going really fast today. The title of this is A Bosom Friend. So Chief Quickwick had attended chapel. And then he, so you could see something, what's going on here is you see that Quickwick is also listening to the Presbyterian chapel, the Calvinist chapel. And Ishmael, so you have these two people that are,
pardon? Did he choose to go himself or was he?
Yes, he went by himself and he sat in the back. So they're getting better acquainted, and Ishmael, after he gets to know him a little bit, he says, you cannot hide the soul. Through all his unearthly tattooings, I thought I saw traces of a simple, honest heart, and in his large, deep eyes, fiery, black, and bold, there seemed tokens of a spirit that would dare a thousand devils. And besides all this, there was a certain lofty bearing about the pagan, which even his uncouthness could not altogether maim. He looked like a man who had never cringed and never had a creditor. So, how many of us can say that? If you're like me, you know, there's plenty of embarrassing things you've done that you still cringe just thinking about, huh? He looked like a man who never cringed and never had a creditor. What's going on here, it seems, is precisely what David was talking about before. A lot of the values are what we assume about savages, about pagans, about somebody who's black or foreigners. The fact that he has a lot of these taboos are being dashed or questioned. And the fact that he had a noble bearing. Well, some people say, oh, this could be the noble savage theory, but it's not really that. But it's the notion that there's something about this anathema to all of us that is really appealing. And you'd almost go as far as to say that you know, even in terms of Christianity, he starts to question, you know, whether only Christian values and only Christian people are good people. So anyway, they're together. And then the next thing that happens is that they sleep together. He talks about them almost as being bride and bridegroom. So, but Melville says this in such a beautiful way. It's not a condemnatory or I'm going to show you way. As I sat there, In that now lonely room, the fire burning low in the mild stage, when after its first intensity had warmed the air, then the only glows to be looked at, the evening shades and phantoms gathering round the casements and peering upon a silent, solitary twain, and so on, I began to be sensible of strange feelings. I felt a melting in me. No more my splintered heart and maddened hand were turned against the wolfish world. This soothing savage had redeemed it. There he sat, his very indifference speaking a nature in which there lurked no civilized hypocrisies and bland deceits. Wild he was, a very sight of sights to see, yet I began to feel myself mysteriously drawn toward him. And those same things that would have repelled most others, they were the very magnets that thus drew me. I'll try a pagan friend, thought I, since Christian kindness has proved but hollow courtesy. I drew my bench near him and made some friendly signs and hints, doing my best to talk with him meanwhile. At first, he little noticed these advances, but presently, upon my referring to his last night's hospitalities, he made out to ask me whether we were again to be bedfellows. I told him yes, whereat I thought he looked pleased, perhaps a little complimented. All right, so they began sharing everything together, including, and Queequeg, the next thing he does is he invites him to worship. He says, you can worship with me, worship my idol with him. And so Ishmael, who's this good Presbyterian, starts to wonder whether he should be doing this or not. But it seemed to be something that was offered in terms of humanity, and it was something beyond the taboos that he always had in his mind. So they had some prayers, and then he ponders this. And it's kind of interesting how logic flips around here. I was a good Christian, born and bred in the bosom of the infallible Presbyterian Church. How then could I unite with this wild idolater in worshiping this piece of wood? I have to look at the time here. Oh, we've got real time yet. But what is worship, thought I? Do you suppose now, Ishmael, that the magnanimous God of heaven and earth, pagans and all included, can possibly be jealous of an insignificant bit of black wood? Impossible. But what is worship? To do the will of God. That is worship. And what is the will of God? To do to my fellow man what I would have my fellow man do to me. That is the will of God. Now, Queequeg is my fellow man, and what do I wish that this Queequeg would do with me? Why, unite with me in my particular Presbyterian form of worship. Consequently, I must then unite with him in his. Therefore, I must turn idolater. There's something with his syllogism that's just a little confusing, isn't it? But he's kind of got his hook. All right. So I kindled the shavings, helped prop up the innocent little idol, now the idol is innocent, and offered him burnt biscuit with Queequeg. All right, and so, in the end, the last sentence here says, then in our heart's honeymoon lay I and Queequeg, a cozy, loving pair. And there's another taboo here I haven't mentioned, that of homosexuality, that's whether they're homosexuals or not doesn't really matter in the text. But what does matter is the kind-hearted, loving relationship that they have. All right, so that's set up. And early on, this is only chapter 10 in a quite a long book, we have just what David was talking about. A lot of our values are in question. Some of us might be a little uncomfortable, but we're laughing. And so there's something with the rhetoric, too, where he's using irony to make it funny. In the last part of this, I want to talk to you, I'm sure you want to hear about Ahab. And in order to talk about Ahab, I need to talk a little bit about the people who were on the ship. So let's get to that next. Knights and squires, and that is on page Oh, let's see. No, I first want to talk about, just briefly, what the shipmates, Captain Plague describes Ahab. You wonder a little bit about Ahab before you meet him. It takes a while to get to Ahab, and it takes a couple hundred and some pages to get to Ahab. But first of all, when they're signing onto the ship, Captain Plague describes him, and he says Ahab keeps close inside the house. He's sort of sick, and yet he don't look so. In fact, he ain't sick, but no, he isn't well either. And how, young man, he won't always see me, so I don't suppose he'll see thee. He's a queer man, Captain Ahab, so some think, but a good one. Oh, thou like him well enough, fear no fear. And he says he's a grand, ungodly, godlike man. Ahab's above the common. Ahab's been in colleges as well as among cannibals, been used to deeper wonders in the waves, fixed his fiery lance and mightier stranger foes in whales. And then he concludes, we're going to run out of time if I read all this, but he concludes, Ahab has his humanities. And that's real important for us to remember. All right. So we'll talk just briefly about the knights and the squires who are on the ship. And they are, that's on page 102, if you have the Norton Critical Edition. All right. You have Starbuck, where we get the coffee from in Washington, huh? But anyway, he's a native of Nantucket, Quaker, uncommonly conscientious. He has a deep natural reverence. And why do you know you've been in the war? He says, I will have no man in my boat who's not afraid of a whale. And I'm sure you want no man in your platoon who's not afraid of an enemy with a rifle, of an adversary. So that's Starbuck. He's also described later on as a man who's right-minded with unaided virtue. He's the one guy that is morally upright, but there's not a whole lot of people there to help him out. Okay, the next person is Stubb, and he's neither craven nor valiant. He's indifferent, good-humored, always calm. He's kind of a goof-off. And he had converted the jaws of death into an easy chair. So I asked Whitey, who would you rather have with you if you were on a whaling ship? This nice, easygoing guy, or this guy who, what would you say?
The first.
Yeah, and my students, interestingly, always pick the easygoing person. That's the person they'd like for a roommate. They wouldn't want Starbucks. Okay, and one of the other major role players here is, besides Stubbs, is Flask. He's pugnacious. He regards every whale as his enemy. Okay? And then you have Tosh Dagle. But anyway, you have that combination of right unaided virtue, somebody who's really easy with just about anything, and another guy, these are your main harpooners, who see whales as an enemy. So that is the dynamics of the major role players in this ship. Now, you want to hear about Ahab, and I'm going to tell you about him in just about 5 minutes, and then we'll be done. I'll let you out in time for chapel. Or for Vespers is what you call it here, huh? All right, Ahab, 109. He looked like a man cut away from the stake when the fire was overrunningly wasted and all of his limbs without consuming them or taking away one particle from their compacted robustness. And the very first thing you hear about Ahab isn't his peg leg. That's what we all see in comics and everything else. But it's this scar that runs down from head to toe. You don't know for sure, but eventually you figure out it's head to toe. It resembled a slender rod-like mark, lividly whitish. It resembled that perpendicular seam sometimes made in the straight lofty trunk of a great tree, when the upper lightning tearingly darts down it, and without wrenching a single twig, peels and grooves out the bark from top to bottom, air running off into the soil, leaving the tree still greenly alive but branded. And would you believe I had a century-old oak tree right out the front window of the cabin that is just like that. Mm. I don't know if Ahab's been there or what. All right, but back to this tension between fate and free will, and this is one of the more beautiful parts of the book, too. Ahab gives these guys, let's see, 142. All right, it's probably all in this part. Okay. He promises them a doubloon, a gold doubloon, which will be worth more than a lot of them are going to earn while they're at sea, if they sight Moby Dick first. So there's this ritual, this happens. And then, and it's just really wild the way this goes on. And Starbuck says to him, "I am game for his crooked jaw, and for the jaws of death too, Captain Ahab, if it fairly comes in the way of the business we follow. But I came here to hunt whales, not my commander's vengeance." And Starbuck goes on to say, "Vengeance on a dumb brute that simply smote thee from blindest instinct. Madness to be engaged with a dumb thing, Captain Ahab, seems blasphemous." Okay, so now we have this really famous passage in Moby Dick on blasphemy. And this is what Ahab says. Hark ye yet again. All visible objects, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in each living act, the undoubted deed, there, some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth the moldings of its features from behind the unreasoning mask. If a man will strike through the mask, how can the prisoner reach outside except by thrusting through the wall? To me, the white whale is that wall, shoved near to me. Sometimes I think there's naught beyond, but 'tis enough. He tasks me. He heaps me. I see in him outrageous strength with an unscrutable malice sinewing it. That unscrutable thing is chiefly what I hate. And be the white whale agent or be the white whale principal, I will wreak that hate upon him. Talk not to me of blasphemy, man. I'd strike the sun if it insulted me. For could the sun do that, then I could do the other. Since there is ever a sort of fair play herein, jealousy presiding all over all creations. But not my master, man, is even that fair play. And he ends it by saying, who's over me? The very next page, and that's what I'll end on. The sunset chapter, and if you're interested in tragedy, very much like tragic convention. Ahab says, I'm demonic. I'm madness maddened. That wild madness that's only calm to comprehend itself. And then he moves down a little bit further on and he says, swerve me, ye cannot swerve me, else you swerve yourselves. Man has ye there, swerve me, and this is another really famous line, it's my favorite line in all of Moby Dick. The path to my fixed purpose is laid with iron rails whereon my soul is grooved to run. So on one part, he's talking about, I'll strike through the mask, you know, if the sun, you know, I'll strike the sun if it defies me. And in the very next chapter, he talks about his path that's laid with iron rails whereon his soul is grooved to run. So there you see the tension in Moby Dick between tragedy and what sometimes is comic, or particularly fate and free will. And Ahab has been vilified in a lot of instances, and it's easy to do that. But if you consider the tension, and you consider what happens with Ahab, he knows he's going to lose. He knows he's not going to survive, but he still fights like a hero. And so I find him such a fascinating character. And the story is just so beautifully written. I'll close with just one more thing. Just before the final chase scene, a lot of people don't know this, but Ahab talks to Starbuck, and Starbuck says to him, "We still can go back. We still can go back." And from beneath his slouched hat, Ahab drops a tear into the Pacific Ocean. And Ishmael tells us, "Nor all the Pacific had the wealth of that one tear," because he's thinking of his wife and family. So for folks who think there's no women in Moby Dick, the very turn just before the chase scene, he thinks about his wife and family. And then he sees Fedallah, who is this embodiment of evil, and his reflection is in the water. He walks across the deck over to Fedallah, and then they start the chase. But anyway, I think it's a great book, and I hope that you'll enjoy it a little bit more, too, after this. And I'll see you later.
Thank you.
You're welcome.